are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives.
Hey everybody, I'm Zale Mednick, and welcome to this second episode in our two-part series regarding the history of Israel and Palestine. In the first episode, I was joined by Israeli tour guide and educator Yoav Biller. We spoke of the ancient ties that Jews and Muslims have to Israel and Palestine, and covered the major historical events up to and including the Six-Day War in 1967. Our conversation resumes from that point up until the present-day conflict, which recently ended in a ceasefire. So here is part two of my conversation with Yoav regarding Israel and Palestine. I hope you enjoy. Yoav, thanks again for joining me to complete the very, very difficult to deliver, but you're doing such a great job because it's such a complicated topic, the history of Israel and Palestine. So thanks for coming back.
My pleasure.
So you tell, we ended last time, we spoke about some themes that we won't touch on again. So I advise people to listen to that episode if you haven't listened to this one. But why don't you take it from here? We stopped at 1967 last time.
Yeah, I mentioned that the generation that lost the two main wars in 1948 and 1967, this generation will not try a third one. Okay, this generation lost everything. I'm talking about the Palestinian. Mm-hmm. But there is a new generation that rises up. And at the one more thing, at the end of the 1970s, Israel signing a peace agreement with Egypt. And by that, Egypt becoming the first Arab state, and it was the most bitter enemy of Israel that signing a peace agreement with Egypt. Egypt will get the Sinai Peninsula back from Israel. The Sinai Peninsula was conquered in 1967, but Israel will never give back Gaza Strip. Why? Whew. Many people here consider it as a crucial mistake by Israel. But all in all, the Israeli prime minister at the time, Menachem Begin, wanted to show to the Israeli population that he didn't give up everything. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay, I give Sinai, but I kept Gaza Strip. Now, at Gaza Strip at this point, you had Jewish communities. And even before 1948, there were Jewish communities in Gaza Strip that were wiped out in the 1948 war. So for Menachem Begin, that's like, at least I can show to my people, I didn't give everything. And I cannot explain the celebrations of Israelis after that first peace agreement. And Anwar Sadat, the Egyptian president, was assassinated shortly after because you're signing peace agreement with your bitter enemy. He was assassinated by a radical Islamic group, the Muslim Brothers in Egypt. But we have peace with Egypt.
Yoav, when you talk about that peace agreement with Egypt, and this is a key theme that comes with any conversation regarding Israel, Palestine, and peace, was Egypt for now, for the first time, recognizing Israel as a legitimate country? Was that part of the peace?
That was part of the agreement. And it's still, I cannot say it's peace. And we, you know, it's peace between politicians. Less the people, the people in the streets in Egypt does not think highly of Israelis. You're not allowed to show Israeli movies in Egypt. You're not allowed to bring Israeli musicians. There is a lot of restriction over there. It was what we call a cold peace. Not warm peace, it's a cold peace. It's peace between politicians. But all in all, our most bitter enemy is now signing a peace agreement with us, and we have a quiet border over there. And I'm fast-forwarding 1987, the new generation of Palestinians that were growing up in Gaza Strip and the West Bank, that is the generation that didn't lose 48 and 67. And just like any other group of people in the world, they want independence. They want freedom. They want to not to see soldiers in the streets. And in 1987, the first intifada, the first Palestinian uprising starts. And for the first time in 20 years, Israel looks at it and says, whoa, there are... Maybe it's not that cool, yeah? We thought that everything is super cool, coexistence. We go into the markets and they're walking in, building our houses and so on, all the stereotype I'm using here, yeah? But now Israel understands there is a problem. And Israel is trying to fight this uprising. And it's not, you know, the best army in the Middle East against a bunch of kids throwing stones and Molotov cocktail. It's not a fair fight. But according to the world, this time Israel is the Goliath, and those Palestinians are David. They are the simple people fighting for their rights. And after a few years, the U.S., America, is really pushing Israel and the Palestinians to sit and negotiate. first in Madrid Convention and then in Oslo. 1992, Yitzhak Rabin, an Israeli prime minister. He was the chief of staff in 1967. He's a very important guy. And he win the election in Israel because he said for the first time, I'm going to end that conflict. I'm going to go for a two-state solution. And he goes for it. And he sits with Yasser Arafat, the most bitter enemy of Israel, the archi-terrorist, the leader of the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which in Israel was considered as a terror attack. They massacred many, many innocent people. And they sit together. They don't like each other, but they sit together and they decide to go for a two-state solution. But before they can, you know, there is so much bad blood between the two. They decide to go for a temporary solution of 5 years, which we call the Oslo Accord. According to the Oslo Accord, you know, in order to build trust, we need to do some moves on both sides. And one of it, and most important, is to divide the Palestinian territories, what is the future Palestinian state. They decide to divide it to three sections. Section A, this is where all the populated cities and towns, Palestinians. Israel said, you know what, I don't want to do anything with those, you know, with Gaza or Jericho or Nablus or Hebron. No, Hebron is different. Or Jenin or all those big populated cities. You control it. You will have the police. We will actually arm. We will train your police. We will even give weapons to the police. You will govern. We don't want anything to do with it. Second is Area B or Section B. Section B, again, no Jews are living in A and no Jews are living in B. B meaning you will govern, you, Palestinian meaning, you will govern all the civilian, all the civic aspect of life, the administration, the tax collection, the education, the police, traffic, you name it. But because many of the roads that leads to the settlements are crossing Area B, Israel said, we will control security. Okay? Mm-hmm. And again, no Jews are living in A or B. And then you have Area C.
And is this Gaza or West Bank area?
And we're talking about Gaza and West Bank at this point. And Area C will be all the land that settlers, at this point, we already have a few hundred thousand settlers, are living in. Now, we're not talking about the international agreed part of Israel, those 78% of the land that was taken in 48, we are talking about the 22% that was taken in 1967, but they didn't annex. Now, C is where you have a few hundred thousand Jews, Israelis, and you have like at that point, like 100,000 Palestinian. But hear me out here. Area A and B together, 40% of the Palestinian territory of the West Bank, and Area C is 60% of the West Bank, with a lot of the fertile land and water and so on. It was a bad deal. It was a bad deal for the Palestinians. Say, look, you know, what can we do with A and B? That's not enough. And it was not a great for Israelis. So if you are coming from the right wing part of Israel, that's like it's a tragedy. It's a catastrophe. It's something that it's your worst nightmare. And if you're coming from the left-wing party, wow, it's amazing. We are the last generation to see the conflict. You know, peace is within reach. We are the last generation in 100 years to see the conflict. Remind you, it was supposed to be a temporary agreement of 5 years. And after that 5 years, most of that land was supposed to become the future Palestinian state, meaning A, B, and most of C was supposed to become the Palestinian state. Now, the core issues that Israel and the Palestinians could not agree upon, the following. What will happen with the right of return? Remind you, there are Palestinians living in refugee camps all over, and you know, also in Canada and Chile and the US, but mainly in Syria and Jordan, sorry, in Syria and Egypt and Lebanon. What will happen with the Palestinian with the right of return? Are they allowed to go back to the future Palestinian state, or are they still allowed to go to the Israeli state, the state of Israel? Now, the second issue is what will happen with Jerusalem? How can we deal with Jerusalem? It's the holiest for Jews. It's the symbol of the Palestinian resistance, third holiest spot in Islam. What will we do with Jerusalem? Third core issue, what will we do with the settlers? We need to uproot most of them. We need to take them back to Israel. That's, we settled them there to begin with. And four, what will happen with sovereignty? Will the Palestinian future state have an army, an airport, a navy? And there are other issues as well regarding water agreements and regarding, again, border and many, many things. But that was a temporary agreement, the Oslo Accord, and that's how we divided it. The Palestinians didn't like the agreement. Israelis didn't like the agreement, but it's temporary. Now, a year later, or a year and a half later, in November 95, Yitzhak Rabin is assassinated, has been assassinated by a Jewish student because of the Oslo Accord. And shortly after, there is a wave of suicide attacks coming from Hamas. Hamas is, as you know, Israel was always talking to the PA, Palestinian authorities, is like the, it used to be the PLO, now we call it the PA. Israel was talking to Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat maybe is a nemesis, but he is representing vast majority of the Palestinian, and he's a moderate. He's not a radical religious Muslim. But in the 80s and mainly in the 90s, started another organization, a Muslim organization called Hamas. Hamas is an alliance or attached to the Muslim Brothers. We're talking about political Islam. The first part in the charter of Hamas is it's one state solution and it's not a Jewish state. Israel should be wiped out from the map. Jews can live here if they want, maybe, but no, it's supposed to be a Palestinian state from the Jordan to the sea. All the whole of Israel was supposed to become Palestinian, and Hamas does not at this point, maybe it's changed a bit, but Hamas at this point does not accept any territorial compromise, any agreement, any two-state solution. And Hamas is launching 4 months of waves of suicide bombers exploding in buses and in restaurants and in coffees. It's terrible. It's terrible. And that leads, there is an election 4 months after the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, there is an election. And Benjamin Netanyahu, the opposition, the right winger, against all odds, is winning the election. Mainly because in Israel, people are looking at what's happening with the suicide attacks and everything, say, look, we were willing to give our edge. We were willing to do historical compromises, territorial compromise, to uproot our own people, to maybe to go to a civil war, who knows? And Yasser Arafat cannot control his people. Either he doesn't want enough and is just bluffing, or he cannot. And then what are we talking with him if he cannot control really Hamas? And anyway, Benjamin Netanyahu has been elected, but he still needs to follow the Oslo Accord, even though he's very much against them. At 1999, after Benjamin Netanyahu would win 1996, and 1999, it's the last time an Israeli Labor, an Israeli left-winger prime minister will be elected. His name is Ehud Barak, and he said, you know what? I feel that Yasser Arafat is bluffing. I'm going to offer him the best offer ever was made to a Palestinian leader. But I want to end the conflict now. You know, the temporary Oslo Accord, you know, those 5 years have passed. Gaza has been ruled now by the PA. It's Gaza is like a sovereign city or a sovereign strip. You still have Jewish settlements over there and you still have army, but not in the city of Gaza. I want to offer him the best offer ever. And Ehud Barak will offer 90% of the entire West Bank and Gaza Strip. 90%, I remind you, to begin with, we're talking about 22% of what was, you know, the original British land of Palestine, Israel. Yeah. I'm going to offer him 90%. I'm going to offer him parts of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem. I'm going to even offer him, I'm going to allow him to bring refugees from 1948 back, not to Israel, of course, but back to the Palestinian territories. And that's the best offer that he will ever get. Even Bill Clinton said a few years ago that it was the best offer yet. From an Israel perspective, this is a very generous offer. From a Palestinian perspective, said, look, we lost everything. All we have now is that 22% of the original land, you know, that we had. And now you want to, now you're offering not even the entire 22%, but like 90% out of those. It's we cannot compromise anymore. And one more thing. Yasser Arafat said, but what will happen with the right of returns of the Palestinians that are living in refugee camps in Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, and, you know, even Palestinian in Jordan? What will happen with, you know, with the land that they lost in 48? You need to give them the permission, to let them at least take permission to go back to their original homes, which is now part of Israel. No Israeli prime minister would ever allow that, because we're talking about now millions of hostile, poor Palestinian refugees, the descendants of those that lost their homes in 48, and now they will go back to the international agreed part of Israel. And Ehud Barak said to Yasser, again, I'm talking narrative. If I'm talking from the Israeli narrative, Ehud Barak said, if you're still talking about the right of return, that means you're not eating for business. You're bluffing, right? If I'm talking from the Palestinian perspective, look, 90% is just not enough. Give me 90% and do land swap for the rest. But give me eat every inch that was lost, because already I'm already lost. And Yasser Arafat knew if he will sign an agreement without the right of return and without even, you know, bringing 100% of the Palestinian territory back to the Palestinian, he will be the next one to be assassinated. Long story short, Yasser rejected that. It's called the Camp David offer of 1999 or of 2000. And shortly after, the second wave of Palestinian uprising started, the second Intifada. Now, this time, Palestinians does not use stones and Molotov cocktail. They have weapon. They have weapon that they managed to smuggle. They have weapon that they managed to build. And they have the weapon that Israel gave them. And we're talking about suicide bombing. We're talking, if you look at what is ISIS did in France or Belgium or elsewhere, that's combined. Add, you know, take that with the 9/11 and many, we're talking about almost on a daily basis or every two or three days, bus has been exploded, a coffee shop or a restaurant. Nowhere felt safe. Israeli did not feel safe. 5 years of terror attack. And of course, if Israel is, and Israel lost 5,000 casualties, and if Israel losing 1,000 casualties, you can be sure that Palestinians lost more, roughly 5,000. Casualties in that second Intifada. And I'm getting to the end, to 2005. At 2005, Israel, actually Bush, the US demanded that Israel will allow and the Palestinian authorities would have an election. And the Palestinian authorities, even though they didn't want that election, and Israel did not want election in the Palestinian territories, they did an election and Hamas won. Not the PA, Hamas, terror organization that swear to wipe out Israel from the map, won the election. Some will say because of the terror attacks. Others will say because the PA was so corrupted, you know, and it didn't, the Palestinian simple people did not feel that it bring change, positive change into their life. And they chose Hamas.
And Hamas, just for listeners, Hamas, when you say terrorist organization, that's how it's viewed by the world. That is not an Israeli view of Hamas.
It's a view of Israel, but it's viewed by the world, by the US, by Canada, by the EU as a terror organization. So for Israel, that's a big no. And also for the Palestinian authorities, in many ways, they hate each other more than they hate us even. So the PA was not willing to give his seat to Hamas. And in 2006, Hamas managed to do a coup. And they threw by force, it was an uprising, a coup, a revolt, and they managed to throw the PA, literally throw them from the windows and from the rooftops of Gaza. And in 2006, up to 2007, Hamas managed to take the lead. And ever since then, Hamas control the Gaza Strip. They didn't manage to do the same in the West Bank because Israel was way stronger in the West Bank and the PA are way stronger in the West Bank.
And Yoav, during all this as well, I recall, I was younger, I recall Israel gave back some land to Gaza during all of this, correct?
This is crucial. At 2005, Israel decided one-sidedly, without any agreement, to withdraw from the Gaza Strip. At this point, you had 1.5 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip and roughly 8,000 Jewish settlers. Israel decided for its own reason, there is a big argument, you know, why, to withdraw from the Gaza Strip, to uproot all its citizens, all its Jewish settlers, and to take all its army soldiers. Ever since 2005, there is no one single Jew, Israeli, in Gaza Strip. But when Israel decided to do that, the PA, the Palestinian Authority, were still in charge of the Gaza Strip. Now, 1.5 years later, 2007, all of a sudden, Israel looks at Gaza Strip, which we just gave back, and all of a sudden, a radical, extreme terror organization is ruling Gaza Strip. And it starts shooting rockets, not on settlers, and it starts shooting rockets, improvised mortar shells and so on, Qassam missiles, into the international agreed part of Israel. Now, if you're coming from an Israeli perspective, after the second intifada of 2000 to 2005, Israelis are looking to the right and left, say, look, there is no partner on the other side. Palestinians are not willing to do historical compromises. They're not really in for solving that conflict. And then there was a shift, a major shift of the Israeli Jewish population to the right wing. Before that, I told you, it was like almost like 50-50. Now, more and more Israelis are losing hope, becoming desperate, and they say, look, there is no partner on the other side. Now, at 2005, when Israel did its disengagement, which really almost caused a civil war, you have soldiers evacuating by force their brothers, you know, Jewish settlers. There was still hope that this will be a step to the right direction, that we can somehow build a better future from that, now that we don't control 1.5 million Palestinians over there. And what did Israel get in return, if you ask Israelis? Missiles. Day in, day out, improvised mortar shells, missiles. And Israel looks at this and said, wow, if this is what happened in the Gaza Strip, which is a periphery, and I'm laughing because a periphery meaning 60 kilometers from Tel Aviv, it's considered in Israel, which is such a tiny country, as a periphery. What will happen if Israel will give the West Bank with, you know, 500,000 Jewish settlers over there and almost, you know, almost 2 million Palestinian or 1.5 million Palestinian, and that's 9 miles of Tel Aviv, what will happen over there? So Israel looks at Gaza and say, wow, this is what happened in that neighborhood when you show weakness. Okay? Mm-hmm. Ever since 2007, Hamas is ruling Gaza, and Israel is putting an embargo, a blockade over Gaza Strip, meaning Israel is monitoring whatever comes to Gaza. Want to check that there is no weaponry or anything, you know, that Hamas can use. And Israel said, look, if Hamas will give the territory back to the Palestinian Authority, to the PA, we will open the gates again. People from Gaza can work in Israel, or we can have some kind of relationship, not saying peace, but some kind of relationship. But as long as Hamas is controlling Gaza and it was democratically elected, that means the Palestinians are not in for a negotiation, are not in for a peace agreement. They're not in for a two-state solution. Therefore, I will do whatever it takes to control Gaza, to differentiate Gaza from the rest. That is the situation in Gaza. Now, we're talking about, wow, it's 40 kilometer, you know, 40 kilometer length, and 15 kilometers or so width. It's a tiny region with 2 million people packed in it. We're talking about people that were, many of them were refugees from 48, and we're talking about poor people that rely on the UNRWA, on the refugee committee of the UN for, you know, to actually manage to end the month. We're talking about poor people living in bad conditions. According to Israel, okay, you're living in bad condition, but we we gave you whatever you take. We gave Gaza to the Palestinian Authority. You could build heaven over there. According to the Palestinian, you know, we are not, we don't even have a territorial connection to the West Bank, to our brother over there. We are isolated. Israel is still monitoring the water. All the water supply to Gaza almost comes from Israel. The electricity comes from Israel. Cellular phones and anything you can think of comes from Israel, or Israel is in charge. And nobody argues that that Gaza people are living in bad condition. The main question is, who is it to blame? Who's responsible for that? Hamas is pointing finger at Israel. Israel is pointing finger at Hamas. Hamas is pointing finger at the PA, Palestinian Authority, claiming they are collaborating with Israel. And it's the PA wants to gain control back in Gaza. And it's a mess. It's tragic. And it's sad. It's sad. It really is. But that was the situation. Since 2007, Gaza has been governed by Hamas and it's isolated. You have many trucks every day. You have hundreds of trucks bringing food from the West Bank and bringing humanitarian aid, bringing medicines, also ships. There is movement of ships, but Israel check everything. Israel monitoring everything.
From the Israeli perspective, like you said, nobody with a heart, nobody is happy about the situation of the people in Gaza right now who are living in those conditions. It might be tempting to say, get rid of that military, have Israel open borders, make things a little bit easier that way. But then you look back to the intifadas, and like you described, there's Israel is petrified to open up their security borders because of things that have happened in the past, right?
But also, you know, it's easy to say, you know, give, you know, throw the Hamas regime and everything will be cool. But there were no election ever since. Yeah, we're talking about 16 years later, there were no election in the Palestinian, not in West Bank, not in Gaza. Now, Hamas have the weapon, but Hamas is also a charity organization. They deal with education and charity and building mosques and hospitals and so on. But they are the sovereign. They are the regime. How can you throw Hamas, even if you wanted, even if you're a poor Palestinian in Gaza, how can you do it? According to Israel, it doesn't matter. You voted them in, you throw them out. You do something about it. And Hamas will never give his seat back to the PA. I remind you that Hamas threw the PA by force from Gaza. Really, you had hundreds of casualties that were thrown. It was very brutal. The PA, policemen and security and were shot dead, were thrown from rooftops. Hamas took it by force, even though it was elected. You know, it had to use force in order to actually gain what they believed is there. And again, ever since then, Hamas is firing rockets to Israel, saying if we are living in condition like this, you will, you know, we will make you live like this as well. Day in, day out, you have mortar shells, you have missiles, improvised missiles. You know, from 2007 until 2009, we're talking about now towns, communities, kibbutzes, moshav, Israeli communities, not settlers, living in the international agreed part of Israel that all of a sudden, since 2007, starting getting bombarded from Gaza Strip. It's like, I cannot even compare. Those people did not experience a siren since 1948 or 1967. They were walking the land. And until the 90s, you had tens of thousands of Palestinians coming from Gaza to walk there. All of a sudden, you have people that are living under daily attacks from the Gaza Strip. In 2009, Israel decided, okay, in this neighborhood, you need to show who's the strongest bully, who's, you know, don't mess with me. And Israel is launching a military operation called Castled. And he's defeating Hamas in Gaza, but it caused also a lot of casualties, innocent casualties. Again, Gaza is one of the most populated places in the world. And Hamas is using its people also as human shields. Hamas is keeping weapon under hospitals and other school, and it's shooting from civilian area. On the other hand, you know, Hamas say, if, you know, it's not like we have F-16 that we can fight Israel on the same ground. We use what we have. So when Israel strike back, And it's like a kindergarten. Everybody says they shot first and we are just retaliating. But it's endless. It's endless. 2009, Israel is launching an operation and gaining 2-3 years of relatively quiet period. I say relatively because you still had attacks and mortar shells. At 2012, after those mortar shells are becoming stronger and stronger, and after Israel decides to launch a second operation called Pillar of Defense, 2012. But this time, Hamas they also grow stronger. They, for the first time, shot missiles on Tel Aviv. That's the center of Israel. It's unheard of. And again, Israel on the battlefield, Israel, of course, it's not a fair fight. Israel, of course, won. And this time, Israel was way better at not harming innocent people. But again, also hundreds of innocent casualties from the Gaza people, from the Palestinians, lost their life in that operation. And Israel said, okay, now we will gain a few years of relatively quiet time. But if you look at Gaza has been isolated. It's the rates of poverty are so high. We're talking about over 60% are unemployed. We're talking about people with no hope, with no dream, stuck in one of the most dense populated areas in the world. You can and Israel say, okay, but you've been held as hostages by your own government, by Hamas. Throw Hamas and everything will be better. The PA is also pushing Israel to put more sanctions because the PA more sanction over Gaza because the PA really wants to control Gaza again. So let's say if Israel provides electricity to Gaza, somebody needs to pay the bills. Israel does not deal with Hamas. So who's paying the bills for the electricity in Gaza? It's the PA that is located on the West Bank. You know, it's such a complicated area. Who will pay for the water in Gaza? It's the PA in the West Bank. Who will pay salaries for the administration in Gaza, which is not Hamas, for school teachers, for all kinds of members that used to be from the PA? It's the PA that will pay their salaries, even though they are not the sovereign. So the PA is putting more and more pressure on Israel, you know, cut the electricity, don't give them what they want, because as long as you give Gaza or Hamas what they want, it strengthens Hamas and it weakens us. It teaches everybody that what you need to do against Israel is to use power, to use terror, to fight Israel. And we, the PA, are doing it, you know, are doing it non-violence. We are cooperating against radical Islamists in within the West Bank. We are working together and we get nothing. And Hamas is growing stronger and stronger. In 2014, we had the last, until today, the last big major event. And just like all other events in Gaza, it started again in the West Bank, in the symbol of Palestinian, which is that white rock, the Dome of the Rock. A Palestinian kid has been kidnapped by a Jewish, radical Jewish terrorist, and they murder him. And from here, it's a fast escalation. And Gaza, Hamas is using now a new weapon. What Hamas did is said, okay, we cannot really cross the borders to Israel. We will dig tunnels, attacking tunnels under the border between us and Israel. And they start launching Hamas fighter. You can call them terrorists, or you can call them freedom, whatever you want to call them. Israel will call them terrorists, of course. And to fight for the first time, you had a threat, not just a mortar shell and missile. You actually had threats of terrorists coming into kibbutzes and moshav, into Israeli communities in within Israel, and taking people as hostages or massacring civilians. And for the first time, you see images of Jewish civilian, Israeli civilians go on their trucks and cars and really fled the areas that is bordering Gaza, you know, being afraid of something like that. And Israel was taken by surprise. Of course, the military, the IDF knew about those tunnels, but it didn't really give it as much credit. And after, you know, 1 month of operation, everybody is claiming they won. But it was, you know, you can't really win this. After that 1 month, Israel lost 70-something. Hamas lost hundreds of fighters for Hamas, but also, again, hundreds of civilians, Palestinian civilians, innocent civilians. And again, and ever since then, we had 6 years of Israel didn't go on any major operation ever since. But Hamas will launch almost on a daily basis kite and balloons, air balloons, like small air balloons with fire that it will land on Israeli fields and set things on fire. And people that are living, Israelis that are living surrounding Gaza, it's living in hell. You know, ever since 2005, 2006, it's living in hell. You have sirens, you have fires, you have a whole generation of Israeli kids that are wetting their beds, that are used to sirens, that are used to all of that. And of course, if I'm talking about Israelis, these Israelis have bomb shelters and stuff. The other side is living in way harder conditions. And again, the only question is, who is it to blame or who is responsible for that? At 2000 and... I don't remember if it was after Trump election, but I don't remember exactly when. Hamas started with a new plan called the March of Return, and they started to do demonstration every week, demanding for the right of return and marching to the fence, marching to the separation barrier between Gaza and Israel. Now, most of those protesters, most of those people attending that demonstration were unarmed. But of course, in between them were also armed Hamas people. Israel made it very, very clear. Whoever comes even close to the fence or to the border will be shot. Why? Because we cannot take any risk of people, you know, bridging the fence and then marching by the hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands to the international agreed part of Israel. According to the Palestinian narrative, it's peaceful demonstrations. People just, you know, want to raise that Palestinian topic once more and to talk about it. And Israel is shooting unarmed people, protesters. According to Israel, they say, look, if you believe in a two-state solution, no way you can support those demonstrations, because those demonstrations talk, they call it the March of Return. They talk about the return. Return to where? Return to the land that they lost in 48. Meaning, if you believe in a two-state solution, you cannot support those demonstrations. Those demonstrations want to end the Jewish-Israeli state.
Yeah.
And that was the situation ever since. Every Friday, you have demonstrations. Every Friday, the first ones were very, very, very violent. You had dozens of Palestinians being shot at the first, but also you had some Israeli soldiers on the other side being shot as well. You have majority of unarmed protesters, and you have minority of Hamas fighters that were hiding in between. That was the situation, and that led us to today.
So what happened a few weeks ago? We're recording this on June 1st. I'm not sure when this will come out, and hopefully there are no new updates after we record this, but we're recording this on June 1st. So what happened a couple of weeks ago, and where are we at now?
So there were a few overlaps that are very, very important to talk about what happens now. So here's the big one. First, Palestinian election. For the first time in 16 years, Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, according to him, he also the governor in Gaza. He promised to have elections. According to all kinds of surveys, Hamas would win the election. Maybe, ironically, the threat was that Hamas would win in the West Bank. And that made the PA and Israel very concerned. Hamas would maybe win Gaza, maybe not. The Gaza people were not satisfied in the last few years under Gaza. Gaza is a failed... It's not even a state. It's a failed autonomy. It's a failed territory. Poverty and infrastructure, nothing works over there. You can blame Israel, you can blame the PA, but it's still, the people are suffering. So maybe Hamas would win Gaza, and maybe he would lose Gaza, but he would, according to the survey, he would win the West Bank. That's terrible news for the PA and for Israel. And Abu Mazen, the leader, decided to postpone the first Palestinian election in 15 years. This is a bitter blow to Hamas. Hamas really, you know, was aiming to get way stronger in the West Bank. Now, according to the Palestinian narrative, they postponed the election because Israel did not allow, said that it would not allow the Palestinian residents of East Jerusalem to take part in those elections. This is a great excuse. It's a great excuse, and you know, it's also a good reason, but that was the reason that the PA used in order to not have the election. And Hamas is furious. Hamas wanted to gain more political power in the West Bank, maybe even throw politically. Hamas is very weak military-wise in the West Bank. He cannot do a coup in the West Bank. The PA and Israel are way stronger. But that's the first part. Second one is Sheikh Jarrah. Sheikh Jarrah is a Palestinian neighborhood of East Jerusalem. Wow, it's so detailed. It's so complex. Sheikh Jarrah is one of those Palestinian neighborhoods in East Jerusalem that were conquered in 1967 war and been annexed as part of Jerusalem, been reunited or re-liberated if you're coming from the Jewish side, been annexed and occupied if you're coming from the Palestinian side. But all in all, it's a Palestinian neighborhood. Now, going back to the 20s and 30s, there were Jews living in Sheikh Jarrah, alongside with the Palestinian neighbors. In the 30s, after a few rounds of violence, most of those Jews had to flee from that neighborhood. And the last Jews that were living in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood fled from there at 1948 war, because Jordan had the east part. No Jews lived, not even one single Jew lived under Jordanian regime in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. Now, who then took all the houses that used to be Jewish? The local Arabs, the Palestinian, Jordanian, they were living in those houses. They were not the owner of the houses. Jordan made it clear that it has a different status, but they were living there. As long as Jordanians are living or are ruling that region, it's all cool. But in 1967, Israel is taking back East Jerusalem. And all of a sudden you have Jews with papers saying, hey, this is my, I bought that apartment. I have papers to show this house is mine. I want it back. Which, you know, it's a fair request. I was kicked by force. Now I have an opportunity to go back to my house, to my grandparent house, to my father's house. Many people still remembered how, you know, they were growing up in those houses. You would say, wow, it's very fair that they will get their houses back, you know. But I remind you, there are many residents in Sheikh Jarrah and other Palestinian neighborhoods that have papers that can show that they had ownership in the west part of Jerusalem and in other parts of Israel. Ooh. Now, in Israel, there is a law that was established just after the 90s. Even throughout the independence war, the Nakba, 1948 war, there was a law saying, if you, and it talks about Palestinian possession, and it says, if you were a Palestinian and you fled from your home in the war, and after this and that date of in 1948, you were not living in that house, the house is now belongs to the state of Israel. It's not yours anymore. You started the war, you're paying the price, but it's Israel state. It's an outrage. If you're a Palestinian, you know, it's my house. I fled, I came back. Now you say it's the state of Israel's ownership because I was not here on, you know, on the crucial date. But that's how it goes. And therefore, all the houses that were owned by Palestinian in West Jerusalem, you know, it's the law of absence. It's they're not allowed to demand their paper. Means nothing. They lost those houses in 48. What can they say? But all of a sudden you have Jews coming and say, hey, this is my land, my house. And then Israel, the state of Israel, in the 70s promoted another law saying that Israeli citizens, Jewish Israeli citizens, that have papers that can prove that this is their former houses from before 48, can demand and claim and get their houses back. This is super unfair. This is super unfair.
Yeah, because there's so many Palestinian people who have been displaced from their homes, and Israel's got a ton of land, so it seems a bit strange that they're trying to take these homes back, even though there is a technicality in the law saying they can.
Yes, and even the Supreme Court understood that, said, ooh, that can be the end of the Zionist dream. If all those Palestinians that have papers that can show their former houses in 48 and say, hey, you know, if you gave our houses back to the Jews that were here before 48, we demand the same treatment.
Yeah.
So the Supreme Court came with a compromise in the 80s. According to that compromise, those Palestinians that are living in the houses in Sheikh Jarrah will not be evacuated. They will not be the owners, but also they will not be evacuated, and they will pay rent. And that rent will be paid, and it's a symbolic amount. And their kids cannot be evacuated. Then first, those Palestinian families signed the agreement, and then they rejected the agreement, said, we're not signing the agreement. If you're coming from a Jewish right-wing perspective, it's a conflict over real estate. We said, okay, you can live in the houses, but you just need to pay rent. You refuse to pay rent. Throughout the 80s, you refuse to pay rent. Throughout the 90s, you refuse to pay rent. We sue you on court. And it's now, just now, last 2 weeks, it was, you know, few Palestinian families have already been kicked, have already been evacuated in the 2000s. And now the court needs to come to an agreement, to a decision regarding the six Palestinian families. And tension grew very, very, very high. Jewish right-winger protesters on one side, Palestinians and left-winger activists from the Israel on the other side, and everybody's talking about those six families. Now, the third part of the background is the Ramadan holy month of Islam. Ramadan is the holy month, fasting month in Islam. Ramadan, every year you have, you know, tension grow high on Ramadan, especially in Jerusalem. It's especially when it connects to the Temple Mount, to the Dome of the Rock. You have tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands Palestinians going every day for the prayers on, you know, on the Dome of the Rock. Jews will call the Temple Mount, and it's sentiment is way more, it's, you know, pro-Palestinian, and energy is high. And this year is not no exception. And all of a sudden, few Palestinians put on TikTok, took videos of them slapping, throwing coffee, humiliating ultra-Orthodox Jews around the Nablus Gate, which is the main entrance to the Muslim quarter in East Jerusalem. And that created a backlash of radical right-winger Jews in West Jerusalem, protesting, violent demonstration, and also attacking Palestinians. Again, Jerusalem is a mixed city. It's the biggest city we have. 900,000 people are living in Jerusalem. 40% of them are Palestinian residents. 40%. And 60% are Israeli Jews. Okay? It's almost a tie. It's a very mixed city. But the Palestinian does not have citizenship. They don't enjoy the same rights and of Israeli Jews in Jerusalem. And they will not accept citizenship. That's like acknowledging the occupation. Most of them will not accept. Anyway, tension grew higher and higher and higher. And unfortunately, every June, or the Hebrew calendar, this time it happened on May, Israel is celebrating the Jerusalem Day, the day that commemorates, or the day that celebrates the 1967 reunification of Jerusalem. Jerusalem, the east part of Jerusalem, being re-liberated.
Which obviously doesn't sit well with the Palestinians.
Oh, and especially not on Ramadan. Now, in the last few years, one of the traditions to celebrate is masses of religious right-wing Jews mainly are coming to Jerusalem on Jerusalem Day and the days that are following Jerusalem Day and the days before Jerusalem Day. And it's a big, big celebration, and those celebrations are very nationalistic. It's not pleasant. And they have one symbol, which is the March of the Flag. In the March of the Flag, they want to show sovereignty. And how would you show sovereignty, but also poking the other side, the loser side? you will march from Nablus Gate, Damascus Gate, which is the main entrance to the Muslim quarter. You will march through the Muslim Gate to the Muslim quarter, and you will cross the Muslim quarter all the way until you will get to the Western Wall. And you will wave your flags high, and you will sing songs, very nationalistic, so very unpleasant song, and you will curse, and people will curse you back. But, you know, you are being protected by the police. You are being protected by the border police. You are the winner. And those March of the Flags are a source of shame for mainstream Israelis. Those March of the Flags, talking on my perspective, as like throwing a pig into a synagogue or into a mosque. Yeah, it's like really poking the other side. But it's a democracy. Yeah. And they can do it.
But it's very much rubbing salt in the wound.
Oh, definitely. And this day, this time, this year, the March of the Flags and Jerusalem Day overlap the most important day of Ramadan, holy month. This is a recipe for a disaster. Tension grew higher and higher. Sheikh Jarrah was boiling as well. You know, demonstrators on both sides. And everything was prepared to the perfect storms. But if that's not enough, we have Israeli politics. The current tension cannot be divorced from the fact that Israel is in the midst of a crisis and no formal government. You know, we had four elections in a year, and in 2 years, the last round of elections saw the entry of the religious Zionist party into the Knesset. Benjamin Netanyahu, in order to keep himself in power, for the first time, really gave legitimacy to a very radical right-wing religious Jewish party that they were never in the parliament. Those are representing the far right. They got legitimacy. Those radical right-wing...
Yeah, Netanyahu legitimized these right-wing extremists in order to help him maintain political...
It's like Jewish supremacy. Those were always the outcast. Nobody really legitimized them. And they are in the coalition with Benjamin Netanyahu. And I'm not getting into how the political system in Israel works, but we need to form coalition. Okay, no, we don't have Democrats and Republicans. We have proportional representations. That means you need to form coalition. Benjamin Netanyahu form coalition with those radical right-wingers, but also with the ultra-Orthodox and with one centralist party. It's one more reason for the flames and for the tensions. Because now we just had an election. Benjamin Netanyahu had like a month to form coalition because he had the strong, you know, he gained the majority of seats. He failed to create a coalition. He failed to get to that number. And just now, the chance of creating a coalition was given to the head of the opposition, a guy called Yair Lapid, coming from a central party called Yesh Atid. Now, Yair Lapid have a golden opportunity, an historical opportunity, to form a coalition, which you can call it the No Benjamin, No Bibi coalition. And it combines Arab parties and very left-wing parties from the Jewish side with right-wing parties. Right-wing, like even more right than Benjamin Netanyahu itself. Right-wing parties, you know, that doesn't have anything in common with the left-wing parties and that doesn't have anything in common with the Arab parties. One thing in common, they want to overthrow Benjamin Netanyahu. Say enough, Benjamin Netanyahu, you know, is doing so much damage. It's about time we'll get rid of him. And then we will form a coalition of change. We'll try to find out how can we agree on certain spots, and we will also avoid fifth election. I remind you, over 2 years, we don't have an active government in Israel, only a temporary one. So that's another thing. And the last thing is Gaza. Hamas, that rules Gaza Strip, was preparing a military for the next round of violence, for the next confrontation with Israel. And it's the perfect storm. Hamas looks at this and said, wow, if I'm entering the scene now Hamas is in one of his weakest point ever in Gaza. The world is against him. And all of a sudden, he can now, if he attack Israel, he's like the guardian angel of Jerusalem, of the White Rock, of the holiest side. He's like the guardian angel of the Palestinian people in Sheikh Jarrah, in that neighborhood. Hamas chose a symbolic day, which is Jerusalem Day. And in order to make a point of he's the guardian angel, he's the protector of Jerusalem, what does Hamas do? He shoots missiles. And like this, we're talking about not improvised, we're talking about good Iranian made or Iranian knowledge missiles on Jerusalem, on the capital of Israel, on Jerusalem Day, which is also the holy days of Ramadan, Hamas shooting missile. And it's important, you know, when you ask who shot first, Hamas shot first to Jerusalem. Wow. This was caught almost as a surprise. Only a few hours before, Israel understood that Hamas is not just, threatening. Hamas is actually going to pull this one off. Hamas is going to shoot missiles to all kinds, but also to Jerusalem, the symbol. And on Jerusalem Day for Israel, this is one line too much. You know, this is a line you don't cross. Not to Jerusalem, not on Jerusalem Day. But this had another backlash because, and that's the last thing that happened. All that time, Palestinian citizens of Israel are looking at what happens. I remind you, there are Palestinian citizens of Israel and they, you know, we have them in the, they're playing in the political arena. They're voting, they are people in the Supreme Court and so on. But they also feel very national, they feel Palestinian, meaning they feel that their historical religious role is to be the guardian angel of the Dome of the Rock, of that white rock. And if you're looking only on your side from TikTok or Instagram, or you don't see the complexities. You only see, you see Israeli policemen brutally attacking protesters on the Dome of the Rock on Ramadan Day, and you don't really see the whole complexity. And then and the feeling is Israel is going hard on the Palestinian on Ramadan and is trying to change the status quo of the holy site of the Dome of the Rock. Now, when Israel retaliate against Hamas in Gaza, hell break loose. And Hamas now have 14,000 missiles aimed not just on, you know, the area that is surrounding Gaza Strip. We're talking about Tel Aviv. We're talking about all the major cities and towns in the metropolitan of Tel Aviv. Vast majority of Israelis are living in the center of Israel. Like 80% of all Israelis are living somewhere between Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and Haifa, and they are all under the threat of Hamas missiles. Hamas is shooting rockets all over Israel. Israel, of course, is retaliating, and Israel knows that Hamas now have an underground city. Hamas have now two cities. There is the Gaza city, and there is a full underground city, the metro, with, you know, tunnels, but it's not a tunnel. It's tunnels that cars and trucks can move in, you know, and weaponry under hospitals and under schools and so on. And for Israel, you know, this is the time, first of all, to settle the bill, to show Hamas not to mess with Israel, but also to get rid of that threat of 14,000 Hamas missile before it will be 40,000 or 50,000 or 80,000 and so on. And if that's not enough, Iran, our bitter enemy in the last, you know, few decades, is, you know, is using fake profiles, using cyber war, you know, is doing what is claimed to be what Russia did in the U.S. election of 2016. It's inflaming the Arab population. And then you see what, because we had rounds of violence between Gaza and Israel. It's not the first time. Well, unfortunately, we're used to that. But to see the Arab citizens of Israel, a minority, but not a tiny minority, we're talking about like maybe 10,000 people, a loud minority, a loud violence minority, going with stones and looking for Jews and lynching Jews, burning synagogues. You know, when's the last time you see synagogues burned to ashes? And all of a sudden, you have the city of Lod, of Lydia, 20 minutes from, it's a mixed city, 20 minutes from Tel Aviv. Synagogues have been burned, Molotov cocktail, weapon, using live rifles, shooting on Jews. And then you have Jewish extremists in Jerusalem and in Bat Yam, another city, going and going for the hunt, looking for to lynch Arabs, which they did. Two Arabs were lynched. They didn't die, but they were heavily wounded. It's not a symmetry. There were a few hundreds Jewish radicals, and you had thousands of Arabs. But all in all, if you're a mainstream Jewish Israeli, you feel that somehow we live in a coexistence, in a way, with those citizens, with those Arab citizens that were living here since 1948. Me, as an educator, I can tell you, those Arabs are citizens, and the vast majority of them are really been integrated into society. You have today Arab doctors, I think even more Arab students for medical students than Jewish medical students. And you have them as in the high tech, and you have them in many civilian aspects, but all in all, it's still, you know, there is a lot of neglection, a lot of discrimination, not by law, but, you know, de facto on ground. And you have less opportunities, and you have, and who are those, let's say 10,000 Arabs? Those are not the educated students. Those are people that didn't finish school, that doesn't see hope. A lot of them are related to crime gangs, you know, and they just use the perfect opportunity to settle their bills. But you're talking about all the mixed Arab Jewish cities like Acre, Akko. Akko is not a poor, poor city like Lod. You're talking about Jaffa. You're talking about Jerusalem. And all of a sudden, even if people like me knew that, you know, it's only on the surface, all this beautiful love and peace coexistence, but under the surface, there's still a lot of issues to talk, gentrification and other things to deal with. But we were hoping that the vast majority, you know, that are integrating more and more and more into society and into politics, we were hoping this will be the main direction. And then you have 2 weeks that Jews cannot leave their homes in many, many, many communities because the roads are being attacked, and Bedouins in the Negev desert are actually putting, you know, stopping cars and checking if you're a Bedouin, you can pass, and if not, you will be burned or stoned. The feeling was the loss of sovereignty, the loss of trust, the loss of, you know, that was the feeling. I can give you many good reasons why for that Arab sentiment, for that violence. But at the end of the day, you know, if you're attacking, even if you're burning the ministry, I don't know, the office of the foreign ministry or the office of or even a police stand, you're against the authorities. I can get that. But if you're going to a Jewish hotel and burn it to ashes or trying to lynch Jews in their cars and managing also, you had some Jews that were murdered and you know, stoning Jewish families, including little kids and so on. There is no excuse for that. I can give you reason, but there is no excuse for that. This is, so it's, and that what happened.
So it's a disaster.
It was a disaster. Now there is a ceasefire. Now Israel and Hamas, which formally are not speaking to one each other, but they manage with the cooperation of Egypt as a negotiator to come to a kind of a ceasefire until the next round. We know that Hamas violated that ceasefire even a day after. They already start sending balloons with fire, you know, to burn fields. But Israel, for now, is not retaliating by force. Hamas, politically wise, Hamas brought back to the center the Palestinian issue. All the world is now talking about Gaza and the Palestinian. You know, for the last few years, people were talking about the Emirates, the peace between Bahrain, Sudan, the Emirates, and the Palestinian topic went lower and lower and lower, you know, with COVID and with radical Islam all over. You know, it felt like the Palestinians are losing that fight. And Hamas managed to bring back the Palestinian topic to the center to get the support of the West, of many, many, not just from the West, of course, to really demolish the sensitive relationship between Arabs and Jews within Israel, to really demolish those new agreements between Israel and Dubai, Israel and Sudan, Israel and Bahrain, those new peace agreements, or you can call it, I don't know, the Abraham agreements. And Hamas also managed to show to the Palestinian people, look, you cannot trust the Palestinian authorities. We are the true representatives of the Palestinian people in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, in the holy site of Jerusalem. and also in Gaza. Israel would claim victory from a different reason. Israel said, look, Hamas, you know, Hamas won. The PR, of course, you cannot really fight the PR. You know, it's they're using people as humanitarian, you know, as human shields. They're sacrificing their own kids and their own civilians. But Israel, on the military field, Israel managed to give a bitter blow to this underground military Hamas city, to wipe out a lot of its Hamas commanders, generals, to wipe out a lot of the weaponry and infrastructure that Hamas built over the years. Now, Israel does not trust Hamas. Israel say Hamas is not in for a compromise. They can say whatever they want, but we understand the next round is a matter of time. Therefore, we need to destroy the ability of Hamas to shoot on Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. So each side is declaring they won. You know, I don't see a victory. I see you can win a battle, a political battle, a military battle, but there is no victory when 2 million Palestinians are suffering in Gaza Strip, and that hundreds of thousands of Israelis that are living in surrounding Gaza Strip are suffering over 20 years now, because it didn't start only 2007, it started even before. That's the end for now.
Yoav, thank you so much. I'm not naive enough to ask you what is the solution here, because it's such a loaded question. And I think what you've done is give us, and I know people will argue, as you said in the very beginning of the first episode, I think you've given us the facts. Some people who are listening might say, but you didn't say everything. And of course, you couldn't say everything, because we'd be here for another 10 hours. But I think you've given a really solid understanding, so people can form their own opinions about what's going on right now and have a greater historical context and present day context for what's going on. And obviously, it's terrible. Nobody wants to see violence. I feel terribly for the people in Gaza. I feel terribly for the people in Israel who are suffering. And I think that you would echo that sentiment. And what you've done is provide a really important understanding of how to look at this situation.
If to end with a slight optimism, I cannot really say hope. I don't know if optimism.
Please.
I think it's a wake-up call for the Israeli society. Both Arabs and Jews, you know, looks at each other with great fear and anxiety and mistrust. And I'm hoping that if there will be one day an Israeli active parliament, after, you know, maybe I'm hoping somebody will form a coalition. There are many things that can be done. And just 2 weeks before the round of violence, there was a major disaster in an ultra-Orthodox site in Israel called Meron, and 45 people were crushed to death and 180 or more heavily wounded. And who were almost the first to show up and to treat those people and to open emergency stations and those were their neighbor Arabs in Israel. Those were the first one to show up, to open their houses, to open their towns, to open their cities, to deal with that Meron disaster. I truly believe vast majority of people want to live peacefully together with the same rights, with the same opportunities. And in the last 2 decades, you would see more and more integration within the Israeli society of Arabs and Jews. But the moderate majority, quiet majority, lost this round. Hopefully it will win the next one and the next one and the next one. And when it comes to Gaza, I don't really have smart things to say. I think it's a problem that is way over our head. Israel and Hamas and the PA cannot solve it by themselves. We need the Arab countries that are surrounding us. I remind you, Egypt is also neighboring Gaza, and they also put a blockade over Gaza because of Hamas. It's not just Israel. And we have, you know, the other Arab countries and hoping, as an international deal, the entire world will come for the rescue and save us from ourselves when it comes to Gaza. I'm talking about save us from this endless tragedy that is going on in Gaza.
Well, we can certainly hope, and I don't mean that sarcastically. We can hope, and we should strive for that, and we need to believe that we can strive for that, and there's a lot of people involved. But I am so grateful for all of your wisdom and expertise that you've brought to this, Yoav. You've spent so much time with me, and I really, really appreciate it. So thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Yoav, is there anywhere people can find you if they want to learn more about you or get in touch with you?
Yeah. People can, I don't know if you can put my email and my website. Also to get more education, but also I can send recommendations of books or even of short YouTube movies that will try to educate people and recommendation of movies or to talk to me. But again, I told you, I'm no expert. I'm educated on the subject, trying to get as much perspectives and knowledge. But yeah, they can definitely email me and I'll try my best to answer.
And I'll put that information all in the episode.
Now. And if the borders will ever be open, they can come visit. I'm leading and guiding tours in Israel and sometimes dual narrative tours with Palestinian colleagues going to Israel and to Palestine and trying to get at least a dual narrative. I would say multi narrative also of that, and hoping they will come.
Awesome. Yoav, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
So thank you everybody for listening to this two-part episode series on the history of Israel and Palestine. It's a complicated topic, as you can tell if you made it through the full two episodes and if you read the news. As Yoav mentioned during our talk at the very beginning of the first episode, it would be impossible to provide a complete history with every single fact and perspective, even if we had spoken for 10 hours. So I do apologize if you felt that certain issues were not covered to the extent that they should have been, or that certain issues should have had light shed on them, but we tried our best to cover as much as possible in the time that we had. Thanks again for joining me. Have a great day.